We have a few questions posted, and if anybody thinks of anything additional, please feel free to post them, and we can also open the phone lines after we get through these. So let's see here. The first question we have is there a break-even point in which the escalating cost of diesel fuel will make it cost-effective once again to go back to stocking inventory?
Well, I think, again, there are several factors that are, we're already starting to see trends, and again, looking at inventory costs, that's something that all the businesses report on their taxes, and something that we've actually been trying to get a handle on is you know, how can we track how inventory levels are changing over time to act as a proxy for the productivity gains or losses within a transportation system. So, you know, each company is going to have a different break-even point because it's going to depend upon the value and the cost of the goods relative to the cost of the transportation system and the cost associated with stockouts. And so each industry is going to have a break-even point, but it's going to be different based upon, you know, various different factors. One of the other things that we're starting to witness already as well is a shortening of some of the supply chains. During the early 1990s, we saw a lot of manufacturing move down south across the border to Mexico and the rise of the maquiladora industries. Well, toward the end of the decade and in the start of the millennium, they were starting to see a definite decrease in the growth of maquiladoras, but even a decline in some of the maquiladora industries as those jobs were moving offshore to China. So Mexico was starting to lose jobs to China because of the wage differentials, and the wage differentials far out-benefited any increase in transportation costs. But what we've started to see over the last couple years is that due to the increase in transportation costs, including not only fuel costs, but also labor costs, but the increase in the unreliability and the congestion on the transportation system, that for some of the higher value goods and the more critical goods, a lot of that production has been moving closer to the U.S., and we're starting to see a pretty significant increase in the maquiladora industry in Mexico as a result. So again, there are those break-even points to where it's always constantly weighing, you know, your total production costs. So you have to look at wage differentials, but also your transportation costs and your whole supply chain management costs.
Okay, thank you. Can you elaborate on rising logistics costs, the main drivers of the rising costs, such as fuel and congestion, and any new supply chain trends to mitigate these costs?
Well, I think, again, we touched on some of that in the beginning. Obviously, driver costs and just the increasing wages and the pressure, because a lot of times the trucking industry is pulling from the same labor pool that the construction industry pulls from. And so, you know, up until the housing boom, we had a real construction boom. And so the need for construction workers was actually having an influence on the cost of drivers for the trucking industry, and oftentimes the construction jobs could offer a better quality of life, allowing them to stay at home more and everything. And so, you know, that was one of the factors that was really leading to a driver shortage. But now, in addition to the pressures just on drivers' wages, you also add to that the escalating fuel costs, as well as the increased costs in terms of environmental regulations and some of the other regulations, such as hours of service and truck size and weight regulations. All of these types of things are putting pressure on the trucking industry. And what we're starting to see now is trucking companies are one of the largest customers of the rail companies. I mean, they are trying harder than the public sector is in terms of trying to divert more trucks to the rail system, especially for those long hauls, because that's where they're having the largest difficulty in terms of being competitive and finding the drivers for those loads.
Okay, thank you. The next question is, do you see fuel costs, driver shortages, road congestion costs, and environmental costs eventually affecting the intermodal competitive distance to 500 miles or less?
Uh, if I understand the question correctly, typically we think of now that that rail can really only compete with truck if we're looking at a longer haul. You've heard some, depending upon the type of service, you might hear 300 miles, but typically you use about a 500-mile kind of minimum in order for rail to really be competitive with truck. And I think the question is, given all of these other factors, could there be a shortening of that minimum competitive length? And I think that, definitely from the trucking industry, there could be. However, the biggest obstacle to that really remains the reliability of the system. And again, it's ultimately the shippers that dictate how things are delivered by dictating the schedule and the timing of those deliveries and the time and the delivery windows. And rail, continues to struggle in terms of being able to provide the service reliability that trucking companies can. And another, pressure that's really facing the railroad companies is the increased pressure to add commuter passenger trains to freight rail lines. And when you look at a system in some of the same corridors where it makes sense potentially for passenger trains, also happen to be, some of the more dense corridors for intermodal traffic, and there's already capacity constraints there to go and try to add passenger trains on those rails. It's just an increasing pressure on that. So I think, again, while there could be situations, especially if you start to get into different types of services and technologies, I think that's going to be the requirement to really see that threshold for rail being competitive with truck on the shorter distances. I think that's going to be the key. Cost will be a factor, but service will be the real key.
Okay, thank you. Let's see, we don't have any questions typed in right now. I think if the operator can give instructions on how to ask a question over the phone. I know that Jocelyn Jones from Federal Highway was going to add something in, so once the operator gives instructions, Jocelyn, I guess if you could just key in that code.
If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. Be sure your phone is not muted and record your name clearly when prompted. Your name is required to introduce your question. To withdraw that request, you may press star 2. Once again, to ask a question, please press star 1 and clearly record your name. Our first question is from Jocelyn.
Hi, Paula and Jennifer. I had more of a comment, not a question, but I just wanted to offer up that for people who are interested in finding out more information about supply chains in their own area, there are several private sector industry groups that focus on these issues. Three that come to mind are the Council of Supply Chain Management Professionals. That would be CSCMP.org. That's a group that I'm involved in. Oftentimes in larger cities, there's another group called Traffic Clubs. And then a third one would be a group called Delta New. I'm not as familiar with that group, but I know they have some transportation chapters around the country. And attending their meetings is a good way to understand some of the transportation and logistical issues in your regions. Thanks.
Thank you, Jocelyn.
Once again, to ask a question or make a comment, you may press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. At this time, there are no other questions.
Thank you. Well, we do have another one that's been typed in. The question is, do you see any potential for increased use of inland ports to mitigate congested major seaports?
Yes, and I think that we're starting to see that. I mean, there's already some great examples of that happening. The Virginia Inland Port up in Port Royal has really had a tremendous impact in terms of increasing throughput at the Port of Virginia. And at the same time, it's really served as a great economic development engine for that rural area. We also see the areas along other East Coast ports, especially where they're experiencing some tremendous growth down in the Savannah, and then also around the Charleston and the North Carolina port areas, looking at at developing those inland port concepts, because basically what it does is it helps to increase the throughput, because a lot of that activity is shifted inward. Most oftentimes, one of the things that really helped the Virginia Inland Port be successful was the fact that they worked very closely with the railroads and were able to come up with a short-haul rail rate that was very truck competitive. So the beauty of that is it's an inland port that's being served primarily by rail, and so you're getting that very short-haul rail intermodal movement, but that was a very collaborative and cooperative effort between the Port of Virginia, Virginia Port Authority, and the railroads and the state and the local communities as well to really come together to make that happen. But it did take some negotiation in terms of getting rail rates that were competitive with truck rates and service that was dependable. And so I think that that we'll start to see more and more, especially in ports such as L.A., Long Beach, New York, New Jersey, some of those that are really starting to feel the pressures of the landside access and the landside congestion. But I was in meetings just yesterday out in San Diego, and someone remarked that they never cease to be amazed by the ability of these ports to be innovative, and just when you think that they're going to be peaking at capacity and everything, they come up with, you know, solutions that allow them to do more with what they've got. And I think that that's one of the things in talking to the private sector, that probably one of the biggest lessons to be learned by public sector is that the private sector really looks at the infrastructure and saying, how can we get more out of what we already have through operational improvements? And inland ports is one of those such operational improvements, if you can get all the players to the board to really make it work and make it a win-win for both public and private sector entities.
And I guess a follow-up to that, could the inland ports be extended to Great Lakes ports?
Yeah, I think definitely. I mean, you know, we're already seeing some, and there's different types of inland ports. I mean, you there in Columbus, Ohio, at Rickenbacker, you already have, I mean, that's an inland port that's primarily based on you know, air cargo being served, but it's also strategically located to serve, to be able to serve some of the traffic from the Great Lakes. I know that up in Niagara, Ontario, in the Hamilton, Ontario, they are looking at trying to develop an inland port concept that would link in to the Great Lakes traffic, as well as some of the traffic coming in through Montreal and some air cargo traffic. And so, you know, there are communities out there looking at the synergies of really, you know, all of the modes and then all of your major traffic lanes, because the Great Lakes are, you know, a very important traffic lane there with a lot of activity and a lot of growth projected to happen within that area.
Okay, thank you. Well, I don't see any other questions typed in at this point.
We do have one on the phone from Al Altoona.
Hello, Paula. This is Al Altoona. We here in Tucson, of course, are looking to develop an inland port operation. And I guess my question is, are we better off trying to approach the the port authorities at Long Beach as opposed to the customers, or what is your best suggestion as far as how do we approach trying to attract some of this business to perform value-added services in our region?
Ultimately, it's the shippers and the requirements of the shippers that are going to drive, even if you have a third-party logistics provider and the shippers just say, okay, I need to get this from here to here, you know, and you're responsible for doing it. It's ultimately understanding the needs and the desires of the shippers that will shape the form in which freight transportation goes. And so I think that anyone investigating inland ports need to understand who is most likely to use your type of facility and what are their requirements. And then if you can meet that and if you can convince them, then they're going to convince the carriers themselves.
So are you saying that basically it was the Virginia Inland Port a situation that was driven by customers then?
by the customers and by the shippers. It was really anchored by getting your first one or two major distribution centers, and then once you get that to happen, other things can fall in place. Same thing with Rickenbacker, that inland port there. It started because you had Limited International, which is a clothing store brand that brings in all of their clothing and everything from China. They served as the anchor tenant for that air cargo facility, which was enough to get them started with the regularly scheduled daily flight from China. And then once you got that and you added the other modes, other things took off. But whenever you look at inland ports, what you typically see is that the first step is to get that first anchor tenant.
Thank you very much.
At this time, there are no other questions from the phone.
Hi, Al. This is Carol Keenan with Federal Highway Administration. One of the products that we have available to our stakeholders and customers is the Freight Peer-to-Peer program. And what you described might be a perfect candidate for one of our peer exchanges, and I would encourage you to go to our Federal Highway website and look at that program, and feel free to call someone in our freight office if you have any questions about that.
And I'm actually just put up a slide about the peer-to-peer program right now, which has website address, email address, and phone number to call for more information. I think we've gotten through all the questions now, it seems like. Paula, is there anything else that you wanted to add before we close out?
No, I just want to restate what I started off saying, is that the material that was presented in today's seminar is a subset of a couple of the lessons that's available in the new NHI Advanced Freight Planning course, and you can go to the NHI website and request that course. And again, it does build upon a lot of the basic information that was provided in the integrating freight into the transportation planning course. And so I encourage you that if this is something that you're interested in and you feel like that you would like to learn more, to go and investigate that course.
Okay, well, thank you. And thank you very much, Paula, for presenting today. And thank you for everyone in attendance. If you do think of additional questions after we close out, I encourage you to post them to the Freight Planning Listserv, or you could send them to Paula or Federal Highway Administration, and we'll get those questions addressed. As I mentioned earlier, the recording of this event will be available within the next week on the Talking Freight website, and I'll send an email out to everybody in attendance when the recording and the presentation and transcript are posted. The next seminar will be held on June 18th and is going to be on freight planning, impacts on air quality and greenhouse gas emissions. This seminar is not currently open for registration on the Talking Freight website, but it should be up by tomorrow, and I'll send an email out to the listserv as soon as it's posted, and also when I send the follow-up information from today's seminar, I'll let you know that the registration is open. But like I said, it should be, if not by this afternoon, then by tomorrow we'll have registration open for the June 18th Talking Freight. I also encourage you to join the Freight Planning Listserv if you haven't already done so. So with that, we'll close out. Thank you, Paula, and thank you everybody in attendance, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Yep.
Okay, very cool. Yeah, I thought that was a good one.
So what'd you think from the MPO perspective? From your old hat? Useful?
Old hat.